She begins by quoting Elvis Costello, the popular singer and songwriter who suggests that writing about music only reduces what music is and what it does. He says it's like dancing about architecture. It's a really stupid thing to want to do. She carries on, though, because she believes there is something in the image of the dance that Costello uses. She contends that when we relate to music, whether it's reading a score, hearing with our inner ear, imagining, playing, singing ourselves, or listening to someone else, it's all rooted in some way in performing. She believes when we say the word music, we think of performances, sounds that live in our bodies, in our memories, as a result of the physical experience we've had. And she asks us to think of all the variables that go into any given performance. The fundamental interactions between musicians and their instruments, for example. The legacy of their teachers and all the performers and performances they've heard, both past and present, from the tradition, in other words. The context of their own historical moment and their own lives and life experience, their own personal disposition, the list goes on. She asks us to listen to violinists of different generations and different stylistic schools. A very early recording of violinist Josef Joachim from 1903, Joachim known for his association with Johannes Brahms. This is a Bach bourré, a dance movement from a solo violin partita. And now here is Yasha Heifetz from a different time with the same dance movement. And now a contemporary player. Even if each of the musicians wants to fulfill Bach's assumed intentions, there is also the sense that each of these performers is breathing life into the work in a new way, based on all the factors we just mentioned. And all this returns us to the image of dance, not just in the case of this stylized dance movement of Bach, but in the sense, too, as Ian McGilchrist says, that musical skills are embodied and therefore largely intuitive. They resist the process of explicit rule following, but rather rely on watching and following with one's eyes, one's hands, and ultimately one's whole being. All that from Dorothea Fabian in her study, A Musicology of Performance. And that brings us to Kurt Nikkanen. He is an esteemed violinist with an international career who serves as concertmaster of the New York City Ballet Orchestra. Born in Hartford, Connecticut, Nikkanen began his violin studies at the age of 3, later studying with Roman Totenberg. At age 12, he gave his Carnegie Hall debut, performing with the New York Symphony. 2 years later, he was invited by Zubin Mehta to perform the Paganini Concerto No. 1 with the New York Philharmonic for a young people's concert. He is a graduate of the Juilliard School, where he was a scholarship student of Dorothy DeLay. Kurt Nikkanen and pianist Maria Astoriadu will present a distinctive recital at Cohen Recital Hall at ESU, East Stroudsburg University, hosted by Larche Concert Group this weekend. We had a chance to speak with him by phone in anticipation of that performance about the program and what it means to be concertmaster of an orchestra dedicated to dance.
In certain respect, leading any orchestra, the responsibilities are quite similar. I mean, you have to put bowings in the parts, and you make certain executive decisions about phrasing, etc., and so on. The difference is, and this is especially true for the conductor, and by the way, conducting for ballet is a highly specialized and difficult job. I mean, I think it's quite underrated. The difficulty of coordinating music and movement on stage is a different challenge from, let's say, coordinating singing on stage as an opera conductor would. It's a completely different sort of coordination. It's more visual. There's more of a kinetic sense. And as a musician playing either solo works with dance or in an orchestral context, you have to be very sensitive. You kind of, as you do it, over the years, you become more and more attuned to the needs of dancers, individual dancers, in fact, who may be tall, may be short, may have certain characteristics. And that's really one of the most fun things about it, is putting together that puzzle. It's a different set of variables than if you were to play the same works just in concert. You have certain restrictions, really negative restrictions, but you simply have to be more aware of how every musical nuance affects movement. And it's quite a challenge. It's an invigorating challenge.
Creative artist that you are, everything you do must inform everything else that you do. So when you're putting your arms around the interpretation of a new piece of music, perhaps, or you're going back to a concerto that you've played many times, or you're playing a chamber recital, I'm sure all of these things must somehow, either in a conscious or unconscious way, inform your making of music.
Yeah, that's quite accurate. And in fact, working in ballet, especially in certain repertoire, I have to say, of course in the Stravinsky and Tchaikovsky works that we do at the ballet, but also in Baroque music. We don't do, let's say, unaccompanied Bach sonatas and partitas per se yet at the ballet, but just seeing their approach to Baroque music in general and seeing how they dance to it kind of has an effect on how you approach, let's say, your playing of Bach. And having played Stravinsky with dance, I mean, I'll never approach the violin concerto in concert the same way. I mean, it's completely different. And same thing with Tchaikovsky. I mean, we're just coming up on Nutcracker season, as you're probably aware. And, I mean, as many times as we've played that ballet, it still has a freshness. And it is only one opus number apart from the violin concerto of Tchaikovsky. So they're almost soulmates, the violin concerto in D major and the Nutcracker. There are so many commonalities, and of course it affects how I would approach the fiddle concerto. So, in fact, I'm looking forward to playing the violin concerto soon because I've got a lot of new ideas, and many of them are because of the effect that my close proximity to the dance world has had.
A harpsichordist who comes to talk with us sometimes, Andrew Appel of the Four Nations Ensemble, always contends that if he didn't dance, that Bach really was like you in proximity to people who were dancing these dances.
Well, I'm pretty sure, at least, you know, the partita movements and their dance titles, Allemande and Courant and or Corrente, sometimes he would use French titles and sometimes Italian. I mean, I'm assuming that he saw all of those things actually dance. And no one knows, nowadays, they're just abstractions. I mean, people see those titles. It doesn't mean anything to most players. It's just, this one's a German dance and this one's a French dance and so on. But I wonder, I mean, most violinists tend to approach the partitas pretty much indistinguishably from the sonatas in that they tend to approach them with great seriousness and sort of with a great deal of sobriety. And I'm not sure that they were conceived that way at all. I mean, the dance movement specifically. And I have a feeling they were a lot more sprightly and probably faster paced than most violinists would imagine. So that really got me interested in playing the Bach again. And a few years back, I revisited all the Bach suites, and it was very interesting how my take on it had changed, kind of without my having thought about it too hard. Just being around dance music so much, I couldn't really think of it any other way. And, well, they tended to go faster, let's put it that way. And so more of a kinetic sense, more of I was imagining what movement might look like. And one of these days I'm going to get a choreographer friend of mine to actually put some choreography to some of it.
Oh, that's thrilling. That's thrilling. And we're going to move now into the Larcher program, but just one more question in that regard, because you do play a lot of fresh music, music by living, breathing composers. Is there a sense that any of these composers you're playing who are your contemporaries are influenced by dance in any way?
It's interesting. I mean, some of the new scores are dance commissions. I mean, I think even the John Adams Concerto, which, if you remember, I played that quite a lot, not for many years, but early on in my career, I played it a great deal. And I had forgotten that initially it was a dance commission. And I'm wondering how that would be with choreography, or if it would be possible to bring it to the ballet at some point. You know, some pieces are conceived with dance in mind from the get-go, and the composer's already thinking, or like Stravinsky was, collaborating directly with the choreographer. And other pieces existed on their own before with no particular intent to use in dance, and the choreographer discovered them. And it seems perfectly natural to do it with dance. And still other pieces, I have to say, that we've chosen, or that choreographers have chosen, that we've played, it has taken me a while sometimes to see that it could be a dance piece at all. Sometimes you're wondering, wow, why would they choose that? It's not particularly rhythmic, but, you know, that also was instructive because it showed me that the choreographer isn't always just looking for rhythm. Sometimes they're looking for just atmosphere or something to hang the steps on that's not necessarily overtly dance-like. That it doesn't always have to be something that's obviously rhythmic. And to watch them interpret, and very often with these new pieces, when they set the steps to them, what you first see is a work in progress. They're still feeling each other out. And also the composer may change things in response to what's going on. So there's a lot of freshness in that.
Tell us what you've planned for us at the East Stroudsburg Cohen Recital Hall. It's very exciting because you've actually got a concerto that you're doing in this setting.
Yeah, that's quite funny. I mean, I don't believe I've done a concerto in recital since I was a kid. When you would play student recitals at school, budding musician didn't know a lot of chamber music or sonatas yet, so you would put the pieces you knew and concertos and so on. I had thought often of this idea of programming a concerto because it's so much a part of violinistic history. I mean, I would say for the majority of the time that we've had recitals at all, for the greater part of the time that recitals have existed, violinists programmed concerti. And that seems like a strange thing to say, but it's true. Throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th century, the greatest violinists always included a concerto in the second half of a recital program. And that kind of fell out of favor. And it's easy to understand why they did it. I mean, it's a simple way of disseminating the piece, and composers must have been quite happy with that. I mean, of course, the best would be to play it with orchestra, but I think most composers from probably Baroque times on expected that their works would be played in many different contexts. And I have seen in modern times certain violinists adopt this sort of thing. I mean, most notably, Perlman plays occasional concertos in recital, and that's sort of an homage to the bygone era when Heifetz and Elman and those guys would do it. And Chomsky, for example, and Fritz Kreisler, and I mean, just about any great that you can think of pre-1950 would have done that. And first time I saw Perlman do it, I didn't know what to make of it. But then after having heard it with piano, I thought, wow, that's completely compelling. It works rather well. If you have a good pianist, and it's just a different context. And the other thought I had about it was, it does in a way force you to approach the concerto with renewed freshness, or at least with different eyes, because it's more of a chamber piece. And so your instinct is to kind of cut away the clutter. Playing the concerto with piano is such a different feel than playing it with orchestra. And the other thing with orchestra is you have maybe one rehearsal plus a dress rehearsal, and you're fighting a large number of players. And so in a way it's refreshing to play it with piano. It seems like a new piece. And a piece that is as familiar as the one that I'm going to be playing, the Bruch Concerto, I think can benefit from a fresh look every now and then, because it's certainly played by everybody a great deal. And it's one of those pieces that is justifiably famous and really never loses its freshness. So I was really, really, really happy that Don asked me to do that, because A, I've wanted to do it my whole life. I've thought, well, what if I started programming concertos? And so I have a feeling this is going to be the first of many. And the other thing is the historical aspect of it, which I find very interesting. I mean, usually these things go in cycles or trends, and a certain recital practice will fall out of favor for a while. You know, there was sort of a tendency that recitals had to consist of three serious works or three sonatas, and it just wasn't musicianly enough to program encore pieces or show pieces or that kind of thing, as they did in the first half of the 20th century. And I always thought, well, where's the fun in that? I mean, there's a time and a place. If you're doing, let's say, a thematic concert, or if you're doing a complete Brahms sonatas or complete Beethoven sonatas, those concerts have a different purpose. But the violin recital, as performed by great violinists from, I don't know, I want to say Joachim, to the present day, meant something entirely different. There would be serious works in the first half, and not necessarily fluff, but very appealing, lighter or virtuoso works in the second half. And that practice has largely fallen out of favor, and I think there's no good reason for it.
Are you bringing a sense of retro when it comes to the violinistic style?
That's a very interesting question, because I think, I mean, whether you played in this context or in a regular orchestral concert, everything you do is informed by the past, and you can't entirely be a violinist of 2016 without a nod to the great tradition and acknowledgement in some way that you're standing on the shoulders of everybody who's played that piece before you, whose performances you grew up with and that you've always loved. And the performances that I grew up with, that I found extremely compelling of the generation before me, those guys were, let's say, born in the 1940s. And they were standing on the shoulders of the violinists who were born in the 1890s or early 1900s. It's a continuous cycle. And I think now, I mean, we have better editions to work from, and you know, you have the Urtext edition of everything. Everybody's researched exhaustively the manuscript and so on, so you can go right back to Bruch's manuscript and see what he wrote. You can even see the bowings and, in some cases, fingerings that Joachim used at the first performance. Same thing with the Brahms concerto. It's always interesting when a great violinist like that had so much input into the solo part. And so I'm constantly aware of that tradition, and I'm aware of every layer that's been added to it since the premiere in the 19th century. And somehow, consciously or unconsciously, you sift through that and you absorb it. And then at the end of the day, you say, well, that's great. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, and I'm going to add this layer to it, which is my perspective growing up when I did, and thinking about music in the 21st century, that I hope is not consciously going out of its way to break away from that tradition, and also not consciously imitating that tradition or making too obvious an homage to the past either. For example, I'm not going to add, let's say, slides for the sake of adding slides that would have been done early in the 20th century or in the late 19th century. I'm also not going to try to be antiseptic and quote-unquote modern about it. I'm just going to try to play it. I hope that any performance I give of any really famous piece, to some extent, clears away some of the clutter and in it brings something fresh by virtue of clarity and simplicity, while not letting go of the expressive nuance and so on that the great violinists of the past were known for. And I mean, undeniably, you can't fail to be influenced by the great violinists you hear. And it's always a question. I think when you're teaching, you discuss that with the better students come to this point sooner than others. And it's always a question, how much of past precedent do you honor? You know, how much of yourself can you inject into it before you are being different for the sake of it? And so I think it's best not to worry about that so much. I mean, everything just kind of percolates through each person as they work on the piece. And even if they were to try to imitate somebody from the past, it's still filtered through a completely different personality and completely different context. And so I think it's sort of like, you know, art students, when they learn, they go to the museums and they study the paintings of the great masters and they copy them. That's how they learn technique. And then they develop their own style from that, you know. And no matter how avant-garde the art is today, I think the best artists are fully aware of the past and the precedent that has been set, and then they break away from it to a greater or lesser degree.
Introduce us to your dear partner in this concert.
Yes, I'm so delighted that my wife, Maria Esteriadou, who is a pianist from Greece, is able to join us. And it's always a joy for us to play together. She's never done the Bruch before, I have a feeling, so it's going to have some freshness there, and she'll probably influence my feeling about it as well, because she's a pianist. She's coming at it from a non-violinistic standpoint, and she may say, hey, look at that. She may notice things about the piece that I've never seen before. And the other great thing is that we're going to play two works that we've played together really from the very beginning of our partnership, the Strauss Sonata, which we have a deep love for, and the Dvorak Romantic pieces, which we used to play a lot when we first started playing together. And then just this year, we started playing it again, and it's such great music. I mean, I'd forgotten what a great miniaturist Dvorak was. So you're going to have some miniatures and some pieces on a grand scale, and all sort of different aspects of romanticism. Oh, and then we have the Mozart Adagio, too, which is really just on the program because it's one of the most beautiful things that I know in the history of music, and Don felt it would make a terrific opener. Anyway, we're so excited about playing this program.
Esteemed violinist Kurt Nickinen, concertmaster of the New York City Ballet Orchestra, who has an international performing career, speaking with us in anticipation of a recital this weekend, and that will be Saturday, November 12th at East Stroudsburg University, hosted by Larche Concert Group, produced by Don Delmezzo. It is a recital that will feature Dvorak, Max Bruch, Mozart, Richard Strauss, at 7:30 on Saturday evening in Cohen Recital Hall. Kurt Nickinen will be joined by pianist Maria Esteriadou, and they will bring us this fascinating bouquet. And for more information, you may check the Larche Concert Group website, and that is larcheconcertgroup.com, larcheconcertgroup.com. Larche is French for bow, and it would be LARCHET, Concert Group, LARCHETconcertgroup.com. Kurt Nickinen, violin, Maria Astoriadu, piano, a violin recital, Saturday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. in Cohen Hall at East Stroudsburg University. For more information on the web, LARCHETconcertgroup.com, LARCHETconcertgroup.com.